Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born in Switzerland, though he's now based in London, where he writes best-selling books described as a philosophy of everyday life. He's produced volumes on love, travel, architecture, and literature. He's also the founder of the School of Life, dedicated to a new vision of education. Alain de Botton, welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much.
Now, you were born in Zurich, so what's your native tongue?
My native tongue is French, and I also speak German and a bit of English. So, a typical polyglot, confused upbringing.
So, was it difficult then when you came, because you came here to school?
I came here to school as a boy of eight. I went to an English boarding school and still working on it with a therapist. And it's not a good idea to send your child to another country in another tongue and hope that they'll get on well. But yes, it's taken me a while to love Britain. I think it all depends how you're introduced to a country. And I didn't have the best introduction.
And philosophy, did that help you?
Yes, I very much have a view that philosophy can be a practical subject. With the way they teach it to you at university, you'd never know. But the very word means, you know, philo, love, Sophia, wisdom in ancient Greek. And that beautiful etymology suggests to me that at its heart, the subject of philosophy is about teaching you to live and die well. That was the original mission of philosophy, and that's one I continue to believe in.
And so that is its practical use, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah. Now, in a little while, I want to talk about your latest book, The Course of Love, but I'd like to start with your first book, which is Essays in Love in this country, in Britain. I think it's just called On Love in America.
Yes, just confusingly.
It seems, though, that you've come full circle. You've returned now to how you started off. So tell me about your first published work.
Well, I was very confused when I started off. So I should say I wrote my first book when I was 22, and it was published around the world when I was 23. So it was a very young beginning, perhaps almost too young, because it was a sort of fast rocket launch into being a writer. What I was trying to do was to write a novel that would very precisely examine the emotions of two people in love. I was very fascinated by romantic love and loved the thought of being able to write a story where not much happened, but the interest was in the psychology. So I've always written novels for people who don't need action in their books. And this book had very little action. It was a close study of two people in the height of romantic love. And it was a young person's book, very intense, very full of feeling. The book did very well. And I sort of left it at that with novels for 20 years and went on to write all sorts of nonfiction books about all sorts of subjects, from Marcel Proust to architecture to travel and other topics.
Well, I mean, that book sold, I think, over 2 million around the world.
It was a big success and still continues to be. One of its biggest markets is South Korea. And someone told me that in South Korea, it's just a rite of passage that you will read Essays in Love as a sort of induction to the realities of adult love. It's got a real audience, and it's a book that, even though I was very, very young, and it doesn't say everything, and it says something's wrong, I think that it's got a certain spirit, which I still like.
I mean, clearly, not only because of that book, because your books are bestsellers all around the world, there's clearly an enormous hunger for accessible philosophy. Do you think that that's because we need to fill a space that perhaps religion used to live?
Well, I mean, for hundreds, thousands of years, we lived in societies where there was a strong element of guidance, particularly around the big sort of pain points of life: death, poverty, illness, growing up, marriage, relationships. These were areas where societies built up stores of wisdom. And it was generally religions that appropriated this wisdom. So there would be, you know, the wise rabbi, the wise priest, etc. What happens in the 19th century is when Europe and then the rest of the world starts to secularize, that tradition, that wisdom tradition, sort of disappears. And what replaces it is museums and the academic study of the arts, literature, etc. So university departments start up teaching us literature. But that's very different from a kind of living tradition. You wouldn't show up at the University of Oxford and say, I've got a crisis with my girlfriend or boyfriend. You know, you'd study Sartre and, you know, maybe Camus and Nietzsche, and maybe these people would tangentially down the line have something to tell you. But the idea of orienting knowledge specifically to the task of consolation, assistance, and in the loose sense, therapy, this sounds utterly bizarre. And it always struck me, as a confused young man, and even to this day, that our culture is remarkably missing this key element. If you don't happen to believe in religion, where do you turn? There's a sort of absence of assistance. And indeed, a lot of sneering that goes on often among elites, and they say, oh, the self-help book is seen as really the dumbest kind of literature. In my view, properly interpreted, a self-help book is a very noble thing. Of course, most self-help books are terrible, but I consider that Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich is a novella that is also a self-help book. Mm-hmm. Proust is a self-help book, if we interpret that word self-help generously, as I think we should.
I was just going to ask you about that, because it is a term that is used about your work. It's something that you would embrace rather than reject.
I would nuance and embrace it in its nuanced version. And indeed, I would criticize anyone who believes that we are not above help and assistance. And even though most of us look like adults as we wander through the world, there's a big part of us that is childlike, out of control, confused and scared. And our societies, despite their immense sort of devotion to treating the needs of the body, you can get 3 million pairs of shoes, you can get a nuanced kind of watch, etc. When it comes to the needs of the mind, or you put it more romantically, the soul, these needs are surprisingly unattended. If you were staying in a smart hotel that aimed to cater for all of your needs and you picked up the phone to the concierge and said, you know, my partner and I are having really rather intractable squabble. Is there anything you can do? And this would be considered utterly crazy. But if you said, look, my Egyptian cotton thread, you know, is a little bit thin, you know, oh, sir, we must help you. So there's a failure to understand what true luxury is. Mm. And in my view, true luxury, in other words, the true satisfaction of the whole human being, all their needs, has to start with the mind, and only much, much further down the line start worrying about socks.
Mm. So it's a whole new genre of literature, though, really, isn't it? You've moved on that concept of helping yourself through words.
Well, I mean, I've tried over now 14 books to always write for a general audience. Charm is really important to me. The seduction of the reader matters a lot, because, you know, you can have lots of interesting things to say. If your way of saying it is clumsy or slow or just boring, you're going to lose your readers. So it's got to get across in a busy age. And broadly speaking, I'm interested always in setting a question behind a book. So when I wrote a book about architecture, the underlying question was, how and why can't we build better buildings? That was the sort of leading thread. So I was looking at a lot of history and theory, etc. But there was a practical search. I wrote a book called The Art of Travel, which was really asking about leisure and travel and how it might go better.
I just would like to pick up on that, because the whole psychology of travel, I wonder what the key is to what we think when we take a journey.
Well, firstly, taking a journey is a psychological process more than a material process. Our society is so focused on the material always, so the discussion is always how much the hotel costs or where to go, etc., rather than what are we trying to achieve for our inner self through travel. And travel, and this is where the history of monasticism and pilgrimage is rather interesting, because in pilgrimage, a religious pilgrimage is an attempt to travel somewhere in order to have an effect on the inner self. And that's still at the back of your mind. But if you, you know, showed up at British Airways and said, I'm looking to transform myself, I've got any destinations, they'd be very puzzled by the language. Bless them. But I think that what we need to be alive to is the fact that when we travel, we're often taking motives that are not purely physical. We don't just want some sun. We want calm, let's say. But calm is a very complicated notion, which isn't just achievable through a certain kind of view, however much views can sometimes matter. So I think we need a more holistic vision of what we're trying to achieve through travel and a more psychological approach.
Of course, you were a writer in residence at Heathrow.
I was. They looked at my thoughts on travel and then invited me along to this rather odd post for a few months. I love aeroplanes, flying, the whole technology, the whole management of airlines, etc. So it was gripping for me to be able to watch that. And I learned a lot, and I wrote a little book about my time at the airport.
Of course, you're enormously well established on the literary circuit and as a public intellectual. You've got legions of fans. You're quite rightly held in huge regard. In your book, Status Anxiety, you look at the way others judge us and how important it is to us, even to you.
Of course. We're all acutely sensitive to what the tribe thinks. Some of those fears and concerns are rational and sane, and others, like the fear of a creature that doesn't even exist in your neighbourhood, like a shark when you're in the middle of dry land, some of these things are irrational. And so the book was an attempt to suggest really ways in which we can deal with that very painful question, which is worrying about what other people think. I don't believe that we shouldn't worry at all, or that we should worry all the time. But we need, I think it's part of anyone's moral education to come to certain views about how they will deal with public opposition, because there is no one who doesn't feel the need for public approval or who won't at some point run into public disapproval, even if it's just, you know, an unpopular decision in the office or a decision that your children don't agree with in the home or whatever it is. But it's part of a kind of psychological toolkit that you need to have worked out. And so that's what this book, Status Anxiety, was about.
As I say, obviously you've done incredibly well, and as a writer, fantastically established. Do you ever look at the blank page and just panic? I mean, what is your process to fill it up?
I'm an expert in panic, and I like to panic about all sorts of things, but I don't panic so much about not having anything to say. It's more about not saying what I want to say well. And I think there's a lot of agony. Sometimes you think, you know, 10 years after you've written something, you think, oh, that's how I should have done it. That's now a crisper, clearer expression. You know, our minds are always a bit vague. We often know a little bit what we think, but not with utter clarity. And I think writing is, you know, really demands that one is utterly on top of what one's trying to say. And that's what I worry about. You know, can I say it as crisply and clearly as it needs to be said? Also, death worries me. I realise that I've only got X number of years to write X number of books. Those books should be the right ones, and they should be hitting the right sort of marks. The pressure ups, I think, as the clock ticks louder.
Do you know the amount of books and the subjects that you'll be doing?
I don't know exactly, but, you know, it might be 12 more books. Now, that's sort of a lot. I mean, it could be a lot less. So I don't know. I think I want to look at education. I want to consider the whole field of psychology head on and other topics. So I've got a file on my computer called Future Books, and it's got lots of slightly mad and sometimes overambitious ideas, but that's where they all go.
Now, I guess what we're all looking for is just happiness, really. That can't possibly ever be a constant state, can it?
No, and it's also a multifaceted state. It's a river through which many tributaries must flow. And so the word is deceptively simple, and sometimes people get impatient with it because it seems to be just an impossible word. So other words can be better. Fulfillment is interesting because the word fulfillment is compatible with quite a lot of difficulty. You can say, I'm leading a fulfilling life, but actually all week I've been in a foul mood. And you say, okay, that's, I understand. Or I'm exhausted, but I'm fulfilled. Mm. Whereas it's hard to say things like, you know, I'm cross, but I'm happy. That doesn't quite sit. So I like the concept of fulfillment. And I think the other thing that most of us want is meaningful lives. And meaning is, I think, generated when you feel that something very core to your own talent, values, and way of looking at the world is being used to solve somebody else's problem. And when you manage to draw out that deep, talented self and match it to a problem out in the world, you have a perfect sort of fit. It's incredibly hard to do that, to know yourself well enough to know really what your core values are, and then to have the luck, skill, talent of actually managing to make money from applying that talent in the world. And, you know, I think all of us go in and out of periods of greater or lesser meaning, always trying, but we don't always manage it.
You mentioned your book on architecture earlier, and of course our mood is very much influenced by our surroundings.
Painfully so, because architecture is very expensive and getting cities right is very, very expensive, as we're in Monocle. You know, Monocle has campaigned brilliantly and very intelligently about how to make cities more attractive. The principles of better cities are not rocket science. There's a few things you need to keep doing, and then you'll get an attractive city. But it's unbelievable the amount of obstacles, both theoretical and political, to getting better cities. So, you know, if one thinks of parts of the redevelopment of London, I look at them and I think all those nice lessons that were learned in the 60s and the 70s in universities about how you create livable spaces, where are they? Mm. You know, sometimes you get good developments, but a lot of them are poor. So it's a conflict between money and art, really. The art side knows what should happen. The money side is often pulling in unhelpful directions.
You have a whole architecture project, Living Architecture. This is a way for all of us to experience fabulous buildings.
Yeah, so a few years ago, I came together with some colleagues and other interested parties to develop an organisation we call Living Architecture, which asks talented architects from around the world to build holiday homes around the UK that can be used for rent by groups, families, etc. And for week-long stays, we're inspired by, you know, holiday rental companies like the Landmark Trust, which exists in the UK, which rents out historic castles. We're not into historic buildings, we're into modern buildings. They're very anomalous in being extraordinarily nice. The plumbing works, the shower works, they're brand new. They're often built by European architects or Asian architects. And it just brings, so you're in the middle of Suffolk or Essex or something, and suddenly you're in this, you know, TARDIS that's come in from another land. And you know, look, it's not saving the world entirely, but it's helping people to open their eyes to what can happen if you're in good quality, well-designed spaces. And we work a lot with schools, we work a lot with development organizations, local governments, to bring them into these houses and go, look, at not necessarily a huge cost, you could be doing various things to your housing standards. And so slowly, slowly, we're helping to change, you know, the conversation that some people have around architecture in the UK.
Tell me about collaborations in your work. You often team up with the photographer Richard Baker, as you did in The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, but you've also co-written with the art historian John Armstrong. Art as Therapy asks and answers so many of the big questions and prompts a completely different way of looking, really. Explain that to
me. So I came together with my wonderful colleague John Armstrong, and he's an art historian by training, an aesthetic philosopher, and really, we wanted to get back to basics on the question of why art matters. And he very much agreed with my own starting point, which is art is there as a resource to take care of us in various different moods. So we looked at, for example, what many people find is the most appealing kind of art, which is pretty art. Flowers in spring, meadows, children playing by the sea, blue skies. These kinds of works of art are very, very suspicious in the eyes of the elite, who think of these things as decadent and, you know, mere postcards, etc. But we took that need very seriously and tried to identify a range of moves that good art makes. It can give us hope. It can give us consolation. It can make us feel not so lonely. It can re-enliven our senses and make us appreciate what's around us. In a range of ways, art is therapeutic in quality.
Your book, The News, A User's Manual, prompted us to think about how we're manipulated by the media. And it also gave rise to The Philosopher's Mail. That was an experiment in thinking differently about the news.
That's right. I wanted to look at, first of all, the incredible power of news on our mentalities. And a lot of it is quite unhelpful to our need. I mean, we need information in order to make better choices and lead our lives. But often the information we get from the news is either irrelevant or exciting in unhelpful ways, because we get overexcited about things that are really far from the things we should be excited about. So I tried to look forward to, it's really a kind of utopian attempt to think, what would the news be in a perfect country? So again, that's a very sort of monocle-ish exercise. So I had fun doing that and then thought, well, let's try and put some of this into action. So we started this thing called The Philosopher's Mail, which was an attempt to reinvent the Daily Mail, which is the world's largest English language news website, as if it were written by philosophers. So we had great fun, and we looked at all the stories that the Daily Mail looks at, celebrity stories, etc. But we try to spin them always. We try to use them as occasions for insight, for reflection, for wisdom. And, you know, we had a wonderful time. I remember writing a piece on Kirsten Stewart's socks and what they meant, and Jennifer Lopez's fall at the Oscars, and all these things that were just starting points for discussions of vulnerability or friendship or intimacy or whatever it was.
Taylor Swift's legs.
Yes, yeah. And you realise that actually there is no subject too small for it not to be able to be connected by logical steps to a rather large question. Mm. So when people say, oh, we're interested in trivia, it's just merely important questions that haven't been properly looked at.
Out of that came the Book of Life.
Yes, well, then I started getting more interested in getting involved in digital media and communicating not just through books, but through other channels. So a number of initiatives followed. We set up something called the Book of Life. That's a online book that keeps growing. New chapters are inserted. And it's deliberately called a book, not a blog or a website or whatever it is, because it's an attempt to say this is as coherent as a book and it's as timeless as a book. Mm. So it doesn't have a sell-by date, so there are no dates on it. And then I started getting interested in YouTube, which was my fascination of last year, and it's ongoing. And so we started making a lot of films on YouTube, and we've now got 1 million subscribers, and it's an enormous part of now of what we do, is to communicate to people through 4-minute films to an audience. So these are always, I'm interested always in communication, and I'm not very snobbish about how I'm going to communicate, whether it's Twitter, YouTube, a book by Penguin, whatever. I don't mind. You know, it's whatever gets the message across.
And of course, you've started the School of Life.
That's right. So the School of Life is an international organization devoted to teaching elements of an emotional education, specifically focused around work and relationships, where we have the greatest problems really managing ourselves. And it now exists in 10 countries. And it's been, you know, one of the great joys, certainly of my life. I love working with our team. Got a 100 people working there now around the world. It's a way of doing a lot of things that I like doing in my books, but out in the world with people.
I went to a course there, How to Find a Job You Love.
Oh, yes.
And discovered, it was just before I started here, discovered exactly what it was that I felt and where it was that I felt like working, and indeed began the next month.
That's fantastic. Wow.
So
well,
what
really, endorsement.
You really did change my life.
That's fantastic.
Actually.
That's so nice to hear. So nice to hear. And I mean, you know, it's very moving because when you write a book, you don't quite know what's happening and you know, you just see a sales figure. What's nice about the School of Life is that, you know, every day in the office, someone will come in and they'll go, that person's marriage. Actually, they're going to stay together. They're going to give it a go, and because we made an intervention. So it's sort of like working in A&E often in a really fulfilling way.
And of course, you've got your whole bibliotherapy service. That's wonderful. Just describe it.
It's part of our ethos that culture should be aligned with the needs of life. And one of the things we offer is something we call bibliotherapy, where a trained psychotherapist who's also a literary graduate will present a kind of reading course. So it's not just like going into a bookshop and saying, you know, what's the new bestseller? It's really saying, who are you? Where are you in your life? What do you want more of? What do you want less of? What's unclear, etc.? And devising a very personal response to your needs. And it's a sort of recipe for what you might read in the next 6 months or the next year. Mm. It's just an attempt to say reading can change lives, but you have to think about what you're reading with a little bit more care.
And it's what I give people as presents now. I don't give them a book. I'd send them on a bibliotherapy course.
Perfect, perfect.
Now, finally, to The Course of Love. It's your long-awaited sequel to Essays in Love. And those looking for a straight tale of romance, I think, will be disappointed. It's a kind of unromantic book, isn't it? I found it absolutely brilliant. It's a roadmap, though, of how to navigate a relationship. And the structure of the book is so interesting. You've got the sort of quasi-narrative and then the italicised commentary the whole way through. So there's the story and then there's what you think.
Yes. So it's unusual at many levels. It's a love story that is not a romantic love story. And it's very much an attack on what we can call romanticism, which we're all the heirs of this idea called romanticism, which kind of fills every pop song, every movie, etc. And it tells us things like meeting the right person is the most important thing, that once you meet them, they will be your soulmate, they will be your friend, you'll never squabble. True lovers don't squabble. True lovers don't have to deal with boring things like money or practicalities. You should wander through meadows. I mean, I'm slightly hamming it up, but there are all sorts of ideas that we're born with and that we grow up with. But these ideas are really unhelpful often to making a proper relationship work, because many people end up in relationships after a few years thinking, am I normal or has something gone wrong with my life? Because I've been in a squabble with my partner about whether the towel should or shouldn't be on the floor. And it's the third time we've had this argument. And this is really rather boring. And I've never seen this in a film. So they must be mad or I'm mad. Mm. I think one of the responsibilities of fiction, of literature generally, is to hold up a mirror to our lives and kind of orient us and give us a sense of where we are in relation to the lives of others. And I think that it sounds odd to say, given how many movies and books, etc., there are on love, that in many ways, there's very few portraits of married life or long-term relationships where it's not catastrophe, no one's trying to kill anyone, there's no obvious melodrama, it's not blissful, it's not terrible either. Now, actually, most of us inhabit that zone. Mm. We keep on keeping on. We struggle. We have moments of crisis, moments of terrible boredom or irritation, and then also moments of tenderness and generosity. And it's always alternating. And I think that sometimes storytellers just leave us at the door of relationships. They take us to the moment, to the first kiss, to the early months of ecstasy, and then the story ends. And that's it leaves us confused and unhelpful. So I wanted to write a book that would be about the next bit, the bit that I think people don't often talk about. So it's not a book, if you want high drama or thrills or people shooting each other or dismembered bodies, don't go here. Because this is really a book for people who love to analyse relationships in quite a lot of detail and are sort of thrilled by unpicking things. And that's what it is. It's a story of two people living in Scotland who are going from being quite immature people, young, very romantic people, and they're learning about how to love. And they're very surprised even that they might have to learn how to love, because isn't it love just a feeling? Well, the novel suggests that it's not, that actually you sort of have to learn a few tricks about how to live with someone and live with yourself.
Love is a skill, not an enthusiasm, as you write.
Indeed. And I think many of us do think that it's merely just an enthusiasm. It's just a passionate feeling. And many of us confuse being loved, which we start by knowing as children. You know, we're just the recipients of love. Someone else cares for us. And then suddenly we have to gradually, with time, adopt this new view, which is actually we might have to love someone. And that means sometimes putting one's own needs aside and actually trying to understand what might be better for somebody else and interpreting them in their worst moods. I mean, one of the big themes of the novel is how we always misunderstand one another. Someone says things like, I don't need you, I'm just going to the next room, you bore me. And that sounds like that person's horrible and very independent. But actually, below those harsh words may lie something like, I'm very vulnerable and I don't feel you want me. Mm. And so we're constantly in relationships saying things to one another that we don't necessarily mean or even understand why we're saying them. And one can only feel sort of global sympathy, really, for how much unnecessary agony there is because we don't know how to talk to one another.
There's the wonderful line, marriage, a deeply peculiar and ultimately unkind thing to inflict on anyone one claims to care for.
It's a pretty big hurdle. You know, I recently went to a wedding of two young people. They were in their early 20s, getting married really young. And I couldn't help but feel worried. They were so nice. They were so beautiful. They were so full of hope. And it's not like I thought, oh, they're headed to, you know, hell or disaster, but I just felt a bit worried by the view that what they were entering into was just naively beautiful. I wanted there to be a recognition that what they were going through was a journey that would really rough them both up, a journey which at points would lead probably both of them to think, I can't bear this. I want to kill them, kill myself, run away. And these feelings of despair are not given enough recognition. Mm. So we're very, despite all the talk about relationships, I think we're still very lonely with a lot of stuff that goes on in love. And for me, books have always been places that we should turn for the lonely stuff, that the taboo stuff, the weird stuff that we feel isolated about.
Alan, finally, what does your wife think about the book?
She's amused by how many people ask her that. I think she read it and she saw that ultimately it's on the side of marriage and it's very realistic about marriage, but it's hopeful. It's hopeful about love. And that's the thing about it. It's an unromantic book that's on the side of love. And indeed, its argument is, in order to really keep and make a relationship go, you have to probably be a bit disloyal to some of the romantic enthusiasms that get us into relationship. That's not a problem. That's called maturity, growing up.
Alain de Botton. The Course of Love is out now. It's published by Hamish Hamilton. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to producer Claire Urban. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.